Unsatisfied, it will retain its interest in the object, form, or idea which is avoiding it. That means if the object is trying to get away, the will continues to pursue it. Should it, however, capture the object, form, or idea, it will assimilate it and then look down to something else. Women, who we understand are representative of the will, know this fact consciously and apply it whenever they want to hold or capture anything whatever. That's lacking altogether in the text. It would seem, therefore, that somewhere things have become inverted, for surely this is what men should both know, that he is representative of the object, form, or idea, and be doing. Whereas in fact he appears quite clueless about the whole procedure, as is evidenced by his being captured and rarely knowing how. If the law be true, then whilst woman is behaving like this, she must represent the object, form, or idea, whilst the man is stressed in the will. What value is it to the will to be avoided in this way? Although as woman it could remain magical, as man it becomes a spineless, frustrated wreck. That's only half the question. I think we better deal with that half first and go back to the beginning. And the law, we said before, we've named it the law of unfinished business. When the energy of the will starts in pursuit of any object, it has committed energy into action, and because of the nature of the definition within the will to pursue that object, the energy of the will cannot stop acting until it has fulfilled the idea that initiated it. In other words, if we mark the will, say the will is going to go 1 mile, then if something doesn't exist at 1 mile to mark the mile, it can't go 1 mile, it hasn't got a measure. And if we put a measure at the 1 mile mark and the will can travel along and come to that measure, it has fulfilled its declared aim, there it's satisfied and assimilates the idea of the attainment to itself. Satisfaction is making full. The thing that is made full is the idea, the motive that started the will in action, and the definition mark that shows that it has attained the definition in the motive. And when these two correspond, the definition with which we start and the end of the action, the place where we finish up, when these two correspond, the initiating will and the attained end, then the will is said to be satisfied. It is satisfied because it has poured itself into the form of the divine motive. Let's pretend for a moment that the motive is a triangle. The will has set out to fill a triangle, and it starts moving in a triangular manner. It goes inside this triangle, travels around, and substantiates itself within it. And when it has filled this triangular form with its own power, when it has filled it so that no more power can be put into it, then the will is said to be satisfied. Satisfied means simply it is made full of being. Its being is simply its power acting in that triangular manner. The will has now attained its end. But supposing the will wants to triangulate itself, starts going along, and begins to produce its triangle, and suddenly at a certain moment another force cuts across it and bends it away, so that it cannot complete the pattern of its intention. Now the pattern of its intention is in the initiating will. If the will does not actually complete it, then the pattern of the action vibrating in the will cannot be satisfied, cannot be filled with the energy of the will. So that if the will is diverted by this second force and made to turn away, it cannot complete its triangular form, and therefore the end of its action is non-correspondent with the form in the initial will. And this non-correspondence is felt as dissatisfaction. If therefore a will has defined for itself a purpose, in this case to triangulate, and it is stopped by some external force from so doing, then that will remains with the pattern of its end vibrating within it, waiting to be filled, and it will wait eternally. And this is what we call unfinished business. The will has defined it that it must make a triangle. Events have stopped the will making a triangle, so the pattern of the initial motive in the will is not fulfilled. It is not filled full of the power of that will. That's the first part. Now it says women know this fact consciously and apply it whenever they wish to hold or capture X. The text says a man. But whatever they wish to capture, they know this law. They feel the infinite longings of a Cleopatra inside themselves. And every time a force diverts them from completing their aim or gaining satisfaction, they seek to dodge the interrupting force. They will go back and come in again, another way. They are thoroughly aware of the nature of eternal dissatisfaction. They have the pattern in the will, and this pattern will not rest until it has fulfilled itself. And women know this, and they call it the rule of no holds barred in the pursuit of the fulfillment of aim. The question then says, it seems that somewhere things have become inverted, for the man should know this fact himself, because he is supposed to represent the idea, the rational understanding of the fact, and do it. But in fact he appears not to know the idea, and he's always being captured by some other entity, maybe the woman, who knows this basic principle. It then says, this being so, the woman must represent the idea and the man must be stressed in the will. Now, we have to distinguish here very carefully, because although this inversion is true from one point of view, it is not true in practice. First of all, a woman as such does not verbally declare her aim. So although there is a pattern in the will of the woman, this pattern is her womanness, she hasn't declared to herself exactly what that aim is. But she moves along the line determined by this pattern. Now let's for a moment pretend that the biological is the female motive, primarily. That her purpose is to serve as a doorway to life. This is her basic motive. She's setting herself up in this way, and her whole motive, whether verbalized or not, is to persuade life to come through that door. Now this life can only come through the door by her engaging in such activities as will lead to the capture of the principle of life, and it follows the tail. Now she has not stated this verbally outside herself to other beings, but if she does, she will refute herself. And most of them are so afraid of saying this to anybody at all But they won't even say it to themselves.
Except maybe in the bathroom, where tenors sing.
The woman, therefore, is really spontaneously impelled by this biological urge to become a door. She is a will to be a door to life. Now the man is committed not to be a door to life, but to be something that goes through the door. He is a form, and he's going to go through the door and emerge in the temporal process. And because of this fact, he's committed to the pursuit of form. But unfortunately, form has to be assimilated and understood before the man can control it. We have then the man and the woman. The woman is agreeing with herself that she will be a doorway to power, which will come through her and embody itself in her favorite symbol of power. Now, the man is not committed in that field. He's committed up here. He's undertaking to look at the world, to engrave it on his brain, to carry the form down below, and then to arrange to posit it through the recipient door. So he's committed to be a searcher for form. But the essential thing about form is this: it cannot be gained without negation. This ties up with the other question in your paper, Laura. Unless the man, as we saw before, unless the man's urge suffers pain, it cannot climb into the head to become idea. So that the man is committed to form means the man is committed to the negation of the will. And the more form he gets, the more the form feeds back to negate the will. Now, what is the function of the negation of the will in man? Because obviously, if the woman is going to be efficient in the pursuit of her end and capture it by devious methods, devious because she keeps avoiding the limiting stimulus, if she is efficient in this way, if she really is efficient, man might as well give up being man and become woman again. But, in fact, something else happens. When man accumulates enough pain, enough limiting factors, in the will, something very peculiar happens to the will that can't happen without it. Let's, for a moment, represent the will as an undulation passing through infinite space. It is not rotated, therefore it has not made a limiting factor. It is the ananda of the Buddhists. It is the ananta, endless serpent of the Hindus. This urge, this eternal infinite seeking without finding, is the essential nature of the absolute female. Count Keiserling represents it in one of his books as a woman swimming, a serpent woman, a serpent with a woman's head, swimming through the ocean from the south to the north. But she's never getting there because she's a woman. If she ever gets there, she passes the equator in the movement and starts moving north and becomes turned, rotating around the pole. It won't be a woman anymore, it will be a man. So this infinite motion, the pursuit of an infinite end, is female. And the peculiar thing about it is that although in its own peculiar way it is uninterrupted motion, which is a definition of bliss, and the same list in list that the spirit blows where, although it is this bliss, it is peculiarly unsatisfied, unfull, because it hasn't turned, and you can't fill unless you turn and make a zone and then go inside it and pack it up. So this bliss is a peculiar kind of bliss. It's an oriental bliss, if you like. It's a bliss for Eastern minds to enjoy. It is the bliss of non-being. And this non-being has within it something else quite other than it. Because when this motion, infinitely traversing infinity, crosses itself, at any point of the crossing, there arises a little vortical spin. Where two forces meet, a vortex is created. Now that vortex is a form. It is a yod point, it is a male element. It is one of the logoi spermatikoi of the ancients. And it has arisen through the interaction of infinite undulations. So somehow these undulations, in their infinity of motions and directions, cannot help producing these centers of vortical spin. But these centers are forms, they are ideas, and they are made. They are restricted. Now, the infinite undulations in their intersections cannot help producing these. And peculiarly enough, the vortical centers produced in this way have a stimulating effect upon this infinite eternal feminine. When the vortical centers occur through intersection of forces, zones of increased tension are generated, and these tensions heighten the awareness. Therefore, it says anciently, the desire of the woman shall be to the man. The desire of the endless serpent, the female, shall be to the little rotations which enhance, make more intense the awareness of the motion of the infinite. And so the infinite femaleness wills to keep in being these finite vortex activities that occur spontaneously at the intersection points. Now once these primary vortices have come to be from every intersection point, something can be done with them. They can be manipulated to make patterns. And some patterns are more efficient at stimulating self-awareness. As soon as one has come to be, the possibility of the rotation makes reflection an actuality. And as soon as we begin to bring them together into certain patterns, we increase the motion possibilities, the arrangements, the values of all these vortices together. And thus we make a compound body which has greater stimulus volume than a single body on itself. The little vortex, which is generated by the intersecting forces, is always a limiting factor, but this very limiting factor is the means whereby the unlimited attains heightened awareness of itself. The kind of awareness in the infinite is an infinite awareness. It has no edges. It is a sentiency, that is, the capacity for reaction to stimulation. But in its infinity, it is not defined in its mode of sensibility. And by introducing these vortical spins, the little male elements, logoi spermatikoi, this awareness is stepped up. So the male elements have a peculiar value to the female elements. That is to say, they increase the sense of existence in infinity. And they do it by the exact opposite, by the finite. So, when we come to look at the man, in passing from the urge level into the pain level of the formal brain, in passing into there, they have negated, finited, limited elements of will, but at the same time they have sharpened the awareness of the nature of the will, the nature of the pleasure process, and so on. If the man abandons this formal pursuit, it is not only the man who suffers, but the woman who suffers, because it is only his pursuit that lifts the whole stimulus level of the relation up. If he stops the pursuit and says, Mabel, I too will go over the hot kitchen stove and we will work shoulder to shoulder frying the sausages. immediately something feels wrong.
Usually he will be raised to the status of king by being crowned with a frying pan for so doing.
Or she will convert, wear trousers and go to work and become a secretary.
Certainly the relation of two infinites together is no relation from the finite value point of view.
So although the man in his struggle for form is cutting his will into bits and necessarily goes through a process of disintegration, relative schizophrenia, in the process of going through it, he is enhancing the stimulus value of this compound vortical structure which is his mind, and thus lifting up the total awareness within the field of infinity. That's the first part of the question. So when man becomes a spineless, prostrated wreck, it simply means his evolution is only half completed. And it doesn't really matter how badly a man is prostrated or wrecked, if he's fortunate enough to come into contact with the idea that this wreckage is a necessary stage on the way to another kind of value, then he will come out of it properly. And if he believes that he should never go into such a state of disequilibrium, that there's something wrong with the disequilibrium, so that he fights it as a disease, his fight inside cuts it further and further into more and more bits, and he becomes progressively more schizophrenic. Let's pretend that there's an artist scrubbing about with vague edges. He's making a drawing, but he's not bothering about the edges. And we say, "What is this?" And he says, "It represents the principle of edgelessness." "Well, it's very good. It's exactly like it. Did you do it on purpose?" "Yes." "So you are satisfied?" "Yes, I am. I have managed to present the principle of edgelessness." He's done it. And he did it actively as a positive act of will, so he feels fine. I went to an exhibition recently in the Liverpool Gallery and saw one or two where such success had been attained. Now, on the other hand, a man struggling for definition and arriving after terrible efforts of definition at the undefinition level of the other man feels terrible. What is the difference between the man who deliberately fuzzes the edges up in order to give you an impression of the principle of edgelessness, and the other man who's striving to draw a clear line with a woolly line instead? The difference is only in this, and this is the whole key to all esoteric principle. The difference is this: did you will it deliberately, or did you suffer it? And there is no other principle. Whatever you do, if you do it by will, as an act of will, it is right for you. But if you suffer it by external stimulation, then it is wrong, and you need more work in that particular field. So if I try to draw a curved line and it comes straight, I have failed. If I try to draw a straight line and it comes curved, I have failed. But if I knew that underneath I really wanted to draw a curve and did one, or a straight line and did one, and so on, then I'm all right. Now, supposing I discover that there are two men here. There's this inner self with the intellect around it, and there's the five-sense mind, the common sense, binding it together. Supposing I discover that the inner self has a purpose, and its purpose is to raise its level of awareness to the nth degree. But meanwhile, in the social context with other beings, my five-sense self and my common sense are trying to assimilate the behavior pattern of other beings. There is now war in the members. St. Paul calls this five-pointed man the natural man, the man of flesh.
There is a war in the flesh between the principle that pursues the infinite raising of response capacity from the inner self, and this is warring against the external imposed behavior pattern from other beings. There is a war in the flesh. In your flesh, there are two kinds of energy, one traveling from center, demanding that you extend your activities, the other traveling from the perimeter, requiring you to conform to the social pattern. Now, just because the social pattern is wrong from outside has been the occasion of the generation of wrong reaction, wrong revolt against the social pattern. If the social pattern is wrong as an imposition, it is much more wrong to allow it to hit on your center and bounce back and produce a revolt against itself, which is entirely mechanical. In other words, the revolution which is reactive against social pressures is as bad as the social pressure that generates it. Whereas the intelligent adjustment of the inner self to the whole situation is to penetrate to the meaning of it. And the inner self is committed to lead the whole being into a higher level. And to do this, it may cause the being to run against society, and sometimes it may cause the being to conform to society in order to curb a reactionary revolution. This is a very important point. We haven't got to mechanically react against social pressures just because they're social pressures. We must act, not react, act from center intelligently. Now, consequently, sometimes the inner self says, draw a curve. But the outer message from society says, draw a straight line. If the person is identified with the social part of his being, he believes he ought to draw a straight line. He's quite sincere, as far as an identified man can be. To the best of his ability, he is. Which means, quite simply, he knows very, very little about himself. But he is identified and thinks good straight behavior is the thing. And that is the law in his flesh, from his training. But inside, the inner self said, I don't want a straight line, that conformity is no good, it's rigid. I want a curve. So it sends, through the same tissue, a message that says curve. The tissue now responds, it tries to curve. But this conviction arising from identification with the social process, that the thing should be straight, also stresses me. And the result is, that your psyche, which is a sensitive substance, assumes the form straight line, energizes it, and immediately the curve tries to combat it. And there arises a conflict in the very substance of being. The conflict between the concept of right behavior, social, and this other concept of curve behavior from the inner self, the immanent spirit. These two, alternating rapidly, have the same effect on the psyche the sudden flashing of these two forms would have if we were to put them on a screen and flash a straight line and a curve very rapidly. The soul becomes a spindle. It goes into a spin because it cannot assimilate these rapid changes properly. Nevertheless, the inner self is not going to give up on that account. It is determined to lift this being to a higher level of response. So if the social mechanism says, be straight and you can be comfortable, the curve one says, comfort is not my aim. And it breaks through the form imposed from the social structure. And the result is, an antisocial behavior pattern.
And just in case we've got an idea that the inner self acts always in curves and the social self imposes the rod, we will now reverse the symbol and say, now this curve represents the principle of binding, which means the social system. And this straight line represents that force that cuts across the system. It suggests that we don't get a fixation. The curve always means the inner self, and the straight line always means the social requirement. Now, if this curved form presents itself in the soul, and the straight line presents itself in the soul, as the soul can only know by assuming the form of its object, then the soul is required to do two things simultaneously, which are mutually inconsistent. It is required to be a circle and a straight line at the same moment. It cannot do it. So what it does do is alternate between the two. It goes into a nice circle, and then it makes an ellipse. It tries to narrow itself. It becomes a straight line. It becomes an ellipse again. It goes back into the circle. And it does this very, very rapidly. When we feel this process going on in somebody, by the empathy process, the feeling into somebody, what we actually feel is a flux of the soul substance assuming the shape of the concept that is controlling it. Now, the object is to raise awareness to the nth degree. That n is the infinite motion. We have to become so subtly aware of motion response that we can regain the original motion of the ananda, the infinite, plus the vortical spin of form. We do not want to lose that vortical spin of form, that finiting factor, because if we lose it, we lose the awareness of the infinite as infinite. If we can present ourselves with the infinite undulation, and at the intersection points generate the vortical seams which heighten that awareness, then we have gained our point. Now there are two dangers here. One is superstressing the form. This is a danger for males, where he fastens himself on the idea and gradually goes out of phase with the field flux, so he becomes utterly unaware eventually that there is a field, and he then deals with what he calls ideas, and he doesn't even know that those ideas are spins of energy within a field, and he then manipulates these ideas like atoms. That's the Keynes mode. The opposite danger is eliminating this form and going back to the infinite rock, the infinite rocking, rather, of the infinite female. These are the two dangers. This lovely, blissful rocking process objectifies itself in the pelvic swing of a pregnant woman and swishes the fluids about in the body of the child, so that he has an image from infinity impressed into his finite body of this blissful undulating state. When this is stressed, it appears as a comfort mechanism later. And it's the thing that drives him to get in somebody's arms to be nursed. But if he stresses the ideas only, the vortical spins, forgets the field, he becomes very, very clear in the mind, and he becomes so clear he makes a very peculiar mistake and thinks he doesn't need to be nursed. And then, of course, he's got trouble. Because, in fact, he's suffering from abstract thought. He's abstracted the thought from the field. He's trying to get out of that absolute pelvis and its swing into a realm of geometrical points. Those are the two dangers. Somehow, for the human being, these two things have to be asserted. the toughest man in the world didn't mind being born as a baby, didn't mind the pelvic swing, could assimilate him. But he could also state that he was he as well. And those people who have tried to avoid field awareness because of its transcendence of the particular, these are the Keynes scientists, they have murdered the field, the Abel, the Abel, God is my father. They have murdered the field in themselves and thus been committed to a particular atomistic formal analysis of the world. In so doing, they become totally isolated in their own parts, part from part, and in society from other beings. We could call that the Keynes heresy if we liked, and the Abel heresy is the one that would have been if he hadn't been killed. It would have been the one that continuously affirms God is my father and doesn't really do much about it. Abel is translated in the Hebrew lexicon as vanity. Vanity is that which comes from nothing. And he came to nothing very quickly. But he came to nothing because he said, God, is my father, Adam. And in so doing, he was going back too soon. Now it's true that his sacrifice was acceptable, because his motive was all right. He didn't want to separate himself from that infinite and tell a lie, the lie being that which was laid down, namely that stone, which is that separativity. He didn't want to tell a lie, and so he turned back into that infinite undulating power, saying, God is my father. And therefore there would have been no evolution from him, and the world would have become a world of praise, something like the angelic world before the throne. There would have been a lot of praising and harping on earth, and it would have been a strange earth with all the churches full. But there was another fellow, Cain, and Cain cut off the motions. And in so doing, he had committed himself to the low road that arrives in Scotland before you. Abel was taking the high road, and he was knocked off. He was demonstrated vain, like a straw in the wind. He went back to Father very quickly. But the amount of energy that had embodied in him got into the earth in Cain, and keeps raising Cain. Cain is committed to expiate his crime. The locked energy of the individual, the Cain function, is committed to become aware of the field by the long process. Abel was aware of it by the short process, and therefore he stopped evolution. There could have been no further temporal progression if everybody had been like Abel and praised God continuously. There would have been no sin, no crime, no law, no awareness of error, and therefore no awareness absolutely of the good. There would just have been the participation mystique with the absolute. But it wasn't good enough. And we know that it wasn't good enough because when Cain murdered Abel, God put a mark on the forehead of Cain that no man might kill him, and said that he would be avenged 7 times if anybody killed Cain. So Cain was committed to this long process of formal education. Now, in a very peculiar sense, then, Cain represents the male mind, the intellective mind, searching for the formal truth of the universe, and murdered Abel represents his wife. That is to say, the female aspect, the Abel aspect, is saying, I like this eternal undulation, I praise it, and my praise is acceptable. But the man is committed, God has put a mark on his forehead while he wears his intellect, a stress on him. And he must use it. And he says, when he hears his horrible punishment, my punishment is more than I can bear. he has to think through it. He becomes so miserable, he goes away into a land of none. None is the word done, judgment, reversed. He has judged and he has murdered through his judgment, and he becomes depressed and he goes away into no judgment. And he wanders about listlessly in that land of none. But after a time, inertia sets in and he gets some babies and eventually they start spreading about. And they get out of the land of none, and the intellective process and the mark of God in his intellect pushes him along, and he begins to discover science. Now science is the Cainish process pushing legitimately to its term, namely the destruction of Cain. In the collision between the vortical spins, the vortices discover, when they clash, that somehow they are not completely isolated. The collision causes energy to pass from A to B, from B to A. Something is transmitted, energy goes from one zone to another. And this finally convinces Cain that isolation is not a fact. The end product of the evolution of Cain, then, is the rediscovery of the power field, the sentient power field of the Absolute, only not in the vague way that Abel knew it in the first place, not in the way your wife knows it, but in the way that you can know it in the male part of yourselves, even the girls, providing they use their minds to realize this fact of the dialectical opposition between the idea and the field. In the clash of individuals, the original isolation motive of Cain, locking up of that energy, has been defeated. It has even been demonstrated a few years ago, about 10 years ago I think, that if you hammer together very hard two solids like two diamonds, you can knock them into each other so they become one, at twice the mass. The mutual interpenetration of absolute solids. And this means the theoretical possibility of the collapse of the whole universe into one point of energy, the original yud point from which it started. When this field is discovered, it is rediscovered. We then have the absolute bliss that we had before the beginning, and within this bliss, we have the vortical spins, which are the generations of pains, of oppositions within the field. And these pains have added up to a rediscovery of the field in a new way, the way we call reflexive. At this point, the man then knows, he knows that he is simultaneously a finite, circumscribed, limited, isolated being, and an infinite, uncircumscribed, sentient power. As to his uncircumscribedness, he is the infinite eternal female. As to the clarity of his ideas gained in the clash of the Cainish conflict, he is a man. If he can manage to be a man, that is to be clear, and yet remain a woman, that is to be field aware, he has completed his work. But if he forgets either one or the other, he is not a divine hermaphrodite.
Yes.
I'll have to leave it to him again. As long as the will is left unsatisfied, it will retain its interest in the object, form, or idea which is avoiding it. That means the object is trying to get away. The will continues to pursue it. Should it, however, capture the object, form, or idea, it will assimilate it and then look down to something else. Women, who we understand are representative of the will, know this fact consciously and apply it whenever they want to hold or capture anything whatever. That's quite an altered text there. It would seem, therefore, that somewhere things have become inverted, for surely this is what man should both know, that he is representative of the object, form, or idea, and be doing, whereas in fact he appears quite clueless about the whole procedure, as is evidenced by his being captured and rarely knowing how. If the law be true, then whilst woman is behaving like this, she must represent the object, form, or idea, whilst the man is stressed in the will. What value is it to the will to be avoided in this way? Although as woman it could remain magical, as man it becomes a spineless, frustrated wreck. That's only half the question. I think we'd better deal with that half first and go back to the beginning. The law, we said before, we've named it the law of unfinished business. When the energy of the will starts in pursuit of any object, it has committed energy into action, and because of the nature of the definition within the will to pursue that object, the energy of the will cannot stop acting until it has fulfilled the idea that initiated it. In other words, if we mark the will, say the will is going to go 1 mile, then if something doesn't exist at 1 mile to mark the mile, it can't go 1 mile, it hasn't got a measure. But if we put a measure at the 1 mile mark and the will can travel along and come to that measure, it has fulfilled its declared aim, thereby satisfying and assimilates the idea of the attainment to itself. Satisfaction is making full. The thing that is made full is the idea, the motive that started the will in action, and the definition mark that shows that it has attained the definition in the motive. And when these two correspond, the definition with which we start and the end of the action, the place where we finish up, when these two correspond, the initiating will and the attained end, then the will is said to be satisfied. It is satisfied because it has poured itself into the form of the divine motive. Let's pretend for a moment that the motive is a triangle. The will has set out to fill the triangle, and it starts moving in a triangular manner. It goes inside this triangle, travels around, and substantiates itself within it. Now, when it has filled this triangular form with its own power, when it has filled it so that no more power can be put into it, then the will is said to be satisfied. Satisfied means simply it is made full of being. Its being is simply its power acting in that triangular manner. The will has now attained its end. But supposing the will wants to triangulate itself, starts going along, and begins to produce its triangle, and suddenly at a certain moment, another force cuts across it and bends it away so that it cannot complete the pattern of its intention. Now, the pattern of its intention is in the initiating will. If the will does not actually complete it, then the pattern of the action vibrating in the will cannot be satisfied, cannot be filled with the energy of the will. So that as the will is diverted by this second force and made to turn away, it cannot complete its triangular form. And therefore, the end of its action is non-correspondent with the form in the initial will. And this non-correspondence is felt as dissatisfaction. If, therefore,
A will has defined for itself a purpose,
in this case to triangulate,
and it is stopped by some external force from so doing, then that will remains with the pattern of its end vibrating within it, waiting to be filled, and it will wait eternally. And this is what we call unfinished business. The will has defined it that it must make a triangle. Events have stopped the will making a triangle, so the pattern of the initial motive in the will is not fulfilled. It is not filled full of the power of that will. That's the first part. Now it says women know this fact consciously and apply it whenever they wish to hold or capture X. The text says a man. But whatever they wish to capture, they know this law. They feel the infinite longings of a Cleopatra inside themselves. And every time a force diverts them from completing their aim or gaining satisfaction, they seek to dodge the interrupting force. They will go back and come in again, another way. They are thoroughly aware of the nature of eternal dissatisfaction. They have the passion in the will, and this passion will not rest until it has fulfilled itself. And women know this, and they call it the rule of no holds barred in the pursuit of the fulfillment of the aim. The question then says, it seems that somewhere things have become inverted, for the man should know this fact himself, because he is supposed to represent the idea, the rational understanding of the fact, and do it. But in fact he appears not to know the idea, and he's always being captured by some other entity, namely the woman, who knows this basic principle. It then says, this being so, the woman must represent the idea and the man must be stressed in the will. Now, we have to distinguish here very carefully, because although this inversion is true, from one point of view, it is not true in practice. First of all, a woman as such does not verbally declare her aim. So although there is a pattern in the will of the woman, this pattern is her womanness, she hasn't declared to herself exactly what that aim is. But she moves along the line determined by this pattern. Now let's for a moment pretend that the biological is the female motive. That her purpose is to serve as a doorway to life. This is her basic motive. She's setting herself up in this way, and her whole motive, whether verbalized or not, is to persuade life to come through that door. Now this life can only come through the door by her engaging in such activities as will lead to the capture of the principle of life, and if you follow the tale. Now, she has not stated this verbally outside herself to other beings, but if she does, she will refute herself. And most of them are so afraid of saying this to anybody at all that they won't even say it to themselves, except maybe in the bathroom where tenors sing. The woman, therefore, is really spontaneously impelled by this biological urge to become a door. She is a will to be a door to life. Now the man is committed not to be a door to life, but to be something that goes through the door. He is a form that is going to go through the door and emerge in the temporal process. And because of this fact, he's committed to the pursuit of form. But unfortunately, form has to be assimilated and understood before the man can control it. We have then the man and the woman. The woman is agreeing
with herself that she will be a doorway to power, which will come through her and embody itself in her favorite symbol of power. Now, the man is not committed in that field, he's committed up here. He's undertaking to look at the world, to engrave it on his brain, to carry the form down below, and then to arrange to posit it through the recipient door. So he's committed to be a searcher for form. But the essential thing about form is this: it cannot be gained without negation. This ties up with the other question in your paper, Roy. Unless the man, as we saw before, unless the man's urge suffers pain, it cannot climb into the head to become idea. So that the man is committed to form means the man is committed to the negation of the will. And the more form he gets, the more the form feeds back to negate the will. Now, what is the function of the negation of the will in man? Because obviously, if the woman is going to be efficient in the pursuit of her end and capture it by devious methods, devious because she keeps avoiding this limiting stimulus, if she is efficient in this way, if she really is efficient, man might as well give up being man and become woman again. But, in fact, something else happens. When man accumulates enough pain, enough limiting factors in the will, something very peculiar happens to the will that can't happen without it. Let's for a moment represent the will as an undulation passing through infinite space. It is not rotated, therefore it has not made a limiting factor. It is the ananda of the Buddhists. It is the Ananta, endless serpent of the Hindus. This urge, this eternal, infinite seeking without finding, is the essential nature of the absolute female. Count Keiserling represents it in one of his books as a woman swimming, a serpent woman, a serpent with a woman's head, swimming through the ocean from the south to the north. But she's never getting there because she's a woman. If she ever gets there, she passes the equator in the movement and starts moving north and becomes turned, rotating around the pole, it won't be a woman anymore, it will be a man. So this infinite motion, the pursuit of an infinite end, is femaleness. And the peculiar thing about it is that although in its own peculiar way it is uninterrupted motion, which is a definition of bliss, and the same bliss in Liszt that the spirit blows where, although it is this bliss, it is peculiarly unsatisfied, unfull, because it hasn't turned, and you can't fill unless you turn and make a zone and then go inside it and pack it up. So this bliss is a peculiar kind of bliss. It's an oriental bliss, if you like. It's a bliss for Eastern minds to enjoy. It is the bliss of non-being. And this non-being has within it something else quite other than it. Because when this motion, infinitely traversing infinity, crosses itself, at any point of the crossing there arises a little vortical spin. Where two forces meet, a vortex is created. Now that vortex is a form. It is a yod point, it is a male element. It is one of the logoi spermaticoi of the ancient. And it has arisen through the interaction of infinite undulation. So somehow these undulations, in their infinity of motions and directions, cannot help producing these centers of vortical spin. But these centers are forms, they are ideas, and they are male. They are restricted. Now, the infinite undulations in their intersections cannot help producing these. And peculiarly enough, the vortical centers produced in this way have a stimulating effect upon this infinite eternal feminine. When the vortical centers occur through intersection of forces, zones of increased tension are generated, and these tensions heighten the awareness. Therefore, it says anciently, the desire of the woman shall be to the man. The desire of the endless serpent, the female, shall be to the little rotations, which enhance, make more intense the awareness of the motion of the infinite. And so the infinite femaleness will, to keep in being these finite vortex activities that occur spontaneously at the intersection points. Now, once these primary vortices have come to be from every intersection point, something can be done with them. They can be manipulated to make patterns. And some patterns are more efficient at stimulating self-awareness. As soon as one has come to be, the possibility of the rotation makes reflection an actuality. And as soon as we begin to bring them together into certain patterns, we increase the motion possibilities, the arrangements, the values of all these vortices together. And thus we make a compound body which has greater stimulus value than a single body on its own. The little vortex, which is generated by the intersecting forces, is always a limiting factor, but this very limiting factor is the means whereby the unlimited attains heightened awareness of itself. The kind of awareness in the infinite is an infinite awareness. It has no edges. It is a sentiency, that is, the capacity for reaction to stimulation. But in its infinity, it is not defined in its mode of sensibility. And by introducing these vortical spins, the little male elements, logos, spermatikoi, this awareness is stepped up. So the male elements have a peculiar value to the female elements. That is to say, they increase the sense of existence in infinity. And they do it by the exact opposite, by the finite. So, when we come to look at the man, in passing from the urge level into the pain level of the formal brain, in passing into there, they have negated, finited, limited elements of will. But at the same time, they have sharpened the awareness of the nature of the will, the nature of the pleasure process, and so on. If the man abandons this formal pursuit, it is not only the man who suffers, but the woman who suffers, because it is only his pursuit that lifts the whole stimulus level of the relation up. If he stops the pursuit and says, "Mabel, I too will go over the hot kitchen stove, and we will work shoulder to shoulder frying the sausages," immediately something feels wrong. Usually he will be raised to the status of king by being crowned with the frying pan for so doing. Or she will convert, wear trousers and go to work and become a secretary. Certainly the relation of two infinites together is no relation from the finite value point of view. So although the man in his struggle for form is cutting his will into bits and necessarily goes through a process of disintegration relative to schizophrenia, in the process of going through it, he is enhancing the stimulus value of this compound vortical structure which is his mind, and thus lifting up the total awareness within the field of infinity. That's the first part of the question. So when man becomes a spineless, prostrated wreck, it simply means his evolution is only half completed. And it doesn't really matter how badly a man is prostrated or wrecked, if he's fortunate enough to come into contact with the idea that this wreckage is a necessary stage on the way to another kind of value, then he will come out of it properly. And if he believes that he should never go into such a state of disequilibrium, that there's something wrong with the disequilibrium, so that he fights it as a disease, his fight inside cuts it further and further into more and more bits, and he becomes progressively more schizophrenic. Let's pretend that there's an artist scrubbing about with vague edges. He's making a drawing, but he's not bothering about the edges. And we say, "What is this?" And he says, "It represents the principle of edgelessness." Well, it's very good. It's exactly like it. Did you do it on purpose? Yes. So you are satisfied? Yes, I am. I have managed to present the principle of edgelessness. He's done it. And he did it actively as a positive act of will, so he feels fine. I went to an exhibition recently in the Liverpool Gallery and saw one or two where such success had been attained. Now, on the other hand, a man struggling for definition and arriving after terrible efforts of definition at the undefinition level of the other man feels terrible. What is the difference between the man who deliberately fusses the edges up in order to give you an impression of the principle of edgelessness, and the other man who's striving to draw a clear line with a woolly line instead? The difference is only in this, and this is the whole key to all esoteric principle. The difference is this: did you will it deliberately, or did you suffer it? And there is no other principle. Whatever you do, if you do it by will, as an act of will, it is right for you. But if you suffer it by external stimulation, then it is wrong, and you need more work in that particular field. So if I try to draw a curved line and it comes straight, I have failed. If I try to draw a straight line and it comes curved, I have failed. But if I knew that underneath I really wanted to draw a curve and did one, or a straight line and did one, and so on, then I'm all right. Now, supposing I discover that there are two men here. There's this inner self with the intellect around it, and there's the five-sense mind, the common sense, binding it together. Supposing I discover that the inner self has a purpose, and its purpose is to raise its level of awareness to the nth degree. But meanwhile, in the social context with other beings, my five-sense self and my common sense are trying to assimilate the behavior pattern of other beings. There is now war in the members. St. Paul calls this five-pointed man the natural man, the man of flesh. There is a war in the flesh between the principle that pursues the infinite raising of response capacity from the inner self, and this is warring against the external imposed behavior pattern from other beings. There is a war in the flesh. In your flesh, there are two kinds of energy, one traveling from center, demanding that you extend your activities, the other traveling from the perimeter, requiring you to conform to the social pattern. Now, just because the social pattern is wrong from outside has been the occasion of the generation of wrong reaction, wrong revolt against the social pattern. If the social pattern is wrong as an imposition, it is much more wrong to allow it to hit on your center and bounce back and produce a revolt against itself, which is entirely mechanical. In other words, the revolution which is reactive against social pressures is as bad as the social pressure that generates it. Whereas the intelligent adjustment of the inner self to the whole situation is to penetrate to the meaning of it. And the inner self is committed to lead the whole being into a higher level. And to do this, it may cause the being to run against society, and sometimes it may cause the being to conform to society in order to curb a reactionary revolution. This is a very important point. We haven't got to mechanically react against social pressures just because they're social pressures. We must act, not react, act from center intelligently. Now, consequently, sometimes the inner self says, draw a curve. But the outer message from society says, draw a straight line. If the person is identified with the social part of his being, he believes he ought to draw a straight line. He's quite sincere, as far as an identified man can be. To the best of his ability, he is. Which means, quite simply, he knows very, very little about himself. But he is identified and thinks good, straight behavior is the thing. And that is the law in his flesh, from his training. But inside, the inner self said, I don't want a straight line, that conformity is no good, it's rigid. I want a curve. So it sends, through the same tissue, a message that says, curve. The tissue now responds, it tries to curve. But this conviction arising from my identification with the social process that the thing should be straight also stresses me. And the result is that your psyche, which is a sensitive substance, assumes the form straight line, energizes it, and immediately the curve tries to combat it. And there arises a conflict in the very substance of being. The conflict between the concept of right behavior, social, and this other concept of curved behavior from the inner self, the immanent spirit. These two alternating rapidly have the same effect on the psyche the sudden flashing of these two forms would have if we were to put them on a screen and flash a straight line and a curve very rapidly. The soul becomes a spindle. It goes into a spin because it cannot assimilate these rapid changes properly. Nevertheless, the inner self is not going to give up on that account. It is determined to lift this being to a higher level of response. So if the social mechanism says, be straight and you can be comfortable, the curve one says, comfort is not my aim. And it breaks through the form imposed from the social structure. And the result is an antisocial behavior pattern. And just in case we've got an idea that the inner self acts always in curves and the social self imposes the rod, we will now reverse the symbol and say, now this curve represents the principle of binding, that means the social system. And this straight line represents that force that cuts across the system. This is just so that we don't get a fixation. The curve always means the inner self, and the straight line always means the social requirement. Now, if this curved form presents itself in the soul, and the straight line presents itself in the soul, as the soul can only know by assuming the form of its object, then the soul is required to do two things simultaneously, which are mutually inconsistent. It is required to be a circle and a straight line at the same moment. It cannot do it. So what it does do is alternate between the two. It goes into a nice circle, and then it makes an ellipse, contracts to narrow itself, it becomes a straight line, becomes an ellipse again, and goes back into the circle. And it does this very, very rapidly. When we feel this process going on in somebody, by the empathy process, the feeling into somebody, what we actually feel is a flux of the soul substance assuming the shape of the concept that is controlling it. Now, the object is to raise awareness to the nth degree. That n is the infinite motion. We have to become so subtly aware of motion response that we can regain the original motion of the ananda, the infinite, plus the vortical spin of form. We do not want to lose that vortical spin of form, that finiting factor, because if we lose it, we lose the awareness of the infinite as infinite. If we can present ourselves with the infinite undulation and at the intersection points generate the vortical seams which heighten that awareness, then we have gained our point. Now, there are two dangers here. One is superstressing the form. This is a danger for males, where he fastens himself on the idea and gradually goes out of phase with the field flux, so that he becomes utterly unaware eventually that there is a field, and he then deals with what he calls ideas, and he doesn't even know that those ideas are spins of energy within a field, and he then manipulates these ideas like atoms. That's the Keynes mode. The opposite danger is eliminating this form and going back to the infinite rock, the infinite rocking, rather, of the infinite female. These are the two dangers. This lovely, blissful rocking process objectifies itself in the pelvic swing of a pregnant woman and swishes the fluids about in the body of the child, so that he has an image from infinity impressed into his finite body of this blissful undulating state. When this is stressed, it appears as a comfort mechanism later, and it's the thing that drives him to get in somebody's arms to be nursed. And if he stresses the ideas only, the vortical spins, forgets the field, he becomes very, very clear in the mind, and he becomes so clear he makes a very peculiar mistake and thinks he doesn't need to be nursed. And then, of course, he's got trouble. Because, in fact, he's suffering from abstract thought. He's abstracted the thought from the field. He's trying to get out of that absolute pelvis and it swing into a realm of geometrical points. Those are the two dangers. Somehow, for the human being, these two things have to be asserted. The toughest man in the world didn't mind being born as a baby, didn't mind the pelvic swing, could assimilate him, but he could also state that he was he as well. And those people who have tried to avoid field awareness because of its transcendence of the particular, these are the Keynes scientists, they have murdered the field, the Abel, the Abel, God is my father. They have murdered the field in themselves and thus been committed to a particular atomistic formal analysis of the world. In so doing, they become totally isolated in their own parts, part from part, and in society from other beings. We could call that the Keynes heresy if we liked, and the Abel heresy is the one that would have been if he hadn't been killed. it would have been the one that continuously affirms God is my Father and doesn't really do much about it. Abel is translated in the Hebrew lexicon as vanity. Vanity is that which comes from nothing. And he came to nothing very quickly. And he came to nothing because he said, God, is my Father, Adam. And in so doing, he was going back too soon. Now, it's true that his sacrifice was acceptable because his motive was all right. He didn't want to separate himself from that infinite and tell a lie, the lie being that which was laid down, namely that stone, which is that separativity. He didn't want to tell a lie, and so he turned back into that infinite undulating power, saying, God is my Father. And therefore there would have been no evolution from him, and the world would have become a world of praise, something like the angelic world before the throne. There would have been a lot of praising and harping on earth, and it would have been a strange earth with all the churches full. But there was another fellow, Cain, and Cain cut off the motions. And in so doing, he had committed himself to the low road that arrives in Scotland before you. Abel was taking the high road, and he was knocked off. He was demonstrated vain, fame like a straw in the wind. He went back to Father very quickly. But the amount of energy that had embodied in him got into the earth in Cain and keeps raising Cain. Cain is committed to expiate his crime. The locked energy of the individual, the Cain function, is committed to become aware of the field by the long process. Abel was aware of it by the short process, and therefore he stopped evolution. There could have been no further temporal progression if everybody had been like Abel and praised God continuously. There would have been no sin, no crime, no law, no awareness of error, and therefore no awareness absolutely of the good. There would just have been a participation mystique with the absolute. But it wasn't good enough. We know that it wasn't good enough because when Cain murdered Abel, God put a mark on the forehead of Cain that no man might kill him, and said that he would be avenged 7 times if anybody killed Cain. So Cain was committed to this long process of formal education. Now, in a very peculiar sense, then, Cain represents the male mind, the intellectual mind, searching for the formal truth of the universe, and murdered Abel represents his wife. That is to say, the female aspect, the Abel aspect, is saying, I like this eternal undulation, I praise it, and my praise is acceptable. But the man is committed, God has put a mark on his forehead while he wears his intellect, a stress on him, and he must use it. And he says, when he hears his horrible punishment, my punishment is more than I can bear. He has to think through it. He becomes so miserable, he goes away into a land of naught. Naught is the word done, judgment, reversed. He has judged and he has murdered through his judgment, and he becomes depressed and he goes away into no judgment. And he wanders about listlessly in that land of naught. But after a time, inertia sets in and he gets some babies and eventually they start spreading about. And they get out of the land of Nod, and the intellectual process and the mark of God in his intellect pushes him along, and he begins to discover science. Now, science is the Cainish process pushing legitimately to its term, namely the destruction of Cain. In the collision between the vortical spins, the vortices discover when they clash that somehow they are not completely isolated. the collision causes energy to pass from A to B, from B to A. Something is transmitted, energy goes from one zone to another. And this finally convinces Cain that isolation is not a fact. The end product of the evolution of Cain, then, is the rediscovery of the power field, the sentient power field of the absolute, only not in the vague way that Abel knew it in the first place, not in the way your wife knows it, but in the way that you can know it in the male part of yourselves, even the girls, providing they use their minds to realize this fact of the dialectical opposition between the idea and the field. In the clash of individuals, the original isolation motive of Cain, locking up with that energy, has been defeated. It has even been demonstrated a few years ago, about 10 years ago, I think, that if you hammer together very hard two solids, like two diamonds, you can knock them into each other so they become one, at twice the mass. The mutual interpenetration of absolute solids. And this means the theoretical possibility of the collapse of the whole universe into one point of energy, the original yud point from which it started. When this field is discovered, it is rediscovered. We then have the absolute bliss that we had before the beginning, and within this bliss we have the vortical spins, which are the generations of pains, of oppositions within the field. And these pains have added up to a rediscovery of the field in a new way, the way we call reflexive. At this point, the man then knows, he knows that he is simultaneously a finite, circumscribed, limited, isolated being and an infinite, uncircumscribed, sentient power. As to his uncircumscribedness, he is the infinite eternal female. As to the clarity of his ideas gained in the clash of the Cainish conflict, he is a man. If he can manage to be a man, that is to be clear, and yet remain a woman, that is to be field aware, he has completed his work. But if he forgets either one or the other, he is not a divine hermaphrodite.